This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to a podcast on the New Books Network. This is New Books in Sports. I am Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you live from Sydney. I am speaking today with Alan McDougall. He is a professor of history at the University of Guelph, and he is the author of what I think is one of the most exciting books I've read in football history and sports history in a while, called Contested Fields, A Global History of Modern Football. It's out in 2020 with the University of Toronto Press. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks for having me on.
Alan, I like to start by asking people how they became sports scholars and how they developed their projects. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you got into this, how you got into studying sport, and how you developed this particular project.
Sure. Well, I guess to take it all the way back, I mean, I think I got into becoming a sports historian because of the fact that after I'd finished my PhD, which was on the Communist Youth Organization in East Germany, I was thinking, okay, well, I got the job, luckily, at Guelph here in Canada. And I was thinking about, well, what should I do to kind of continue in this field? I'm going to be here for a long time, I hope. And, of course, the number one passion in my life, really, outside of friends and family, is, of course, sport. So that was the moment when the penny dropped, really. And I thought, well, I can just do sport as my research life. And so my first project in sport was a history of football in communist East Germany, The People's Game, which came out in 2014 and was quite well received. And subsequent to that, I ended up working on this second book on a much broader scale and trying to reach a much wider audience, Contested Fields, which, as you said, is a global history of football. But I guess the other answer to kind of jump back further is to say that I've always been a huge lover of football. I played as a kid. I was actually I was a fairly good player until studies became more important. I was on the junior books at Tottenham Hotspurs. And so I played at a fairly high standard for a while. So I'd always loved playing football. My earliest memories, I think, were of the 1982 World Cup. And I was, for some reason, despite the family name, I have no Scottish background, but I was a huge Scotland fan at that World Cup. I think because my club team, Liverpool, had lots of Scottish players, whereas England didn't. So I have the strong memories of, football really shaping every phase of my life as a kid, both playing it and watching it. And so, later on, to be able to turn that into academic work was, it was really a dream come true without sounding too cliched.
No, I mean, we were chatting for a very brief bit about this before we started the interview, It is a pretty lucky position we're in, although in some ways I think, studying sport is tough too. Like, people maybe don't take sport as seriously as they could do. One of the things I thought was really interesting before I even started reading your book was that I noticed it's actually in an international themes and issues series. So it's not aimed principally at an audience of people who are like, oh, I'm already drinking the sport Kool-Aid. This is aimed at a very broad audience. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about how you conceived of situating this book kind of in the field and who you hope it speaks to.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky to work at the University of Toronto Press with the series editor. It's the International Themes and Issues series that the UTP runs with the Canadian Historical Association. The series editor, Pierre-Yves Saunier, is a you know, very well-known transnational historian, and also, like so many of us, a huge sports fan. So in my conversations with him, we started to think about ways in which we could introduce a sporting topic into this series. And, of course, football was the obvious one. Of course, there's the sort of FIFA propaganda line about the world's game, but, of course, we know that there's also a lot of truth to that. So it was really interesting. And, you know, I suppose I was, you know, to go back to my own personal experience, I mean, my first understanding of the world and other countries came from football. I mean, that sounds, you know, quite basic, but as a kid, you know, through Panini sticker albums for the 82 and 86 World Cup, through watching games on television, through listening on the radio, you know, that was how I first encountered the Eastern Bloc, you know, communist teams from communist Eastern Europe. That's how I first encountered probably South American teams. So football was my first sort of experience in my life as a kind of idea of international exchange where borders could be crossed and they weren't barriers that were put up between countries. So I think that was in my mind. And, you know, my own interest in some of the research I'd done on East German football had been I'd been interested in kind of breaking down the cliche that the communist East Germany was just this closed society defined by the Berlin Wall, defined by the Stasi. And actually, in my work on East German football, I looked, you know, quite seriously at how football officials and players and fans and coaches in East Germany tried to reach out to the rest of the world, obviously to other communist countries, but also to the West. And this was always quite a fraught process. But I was interested in internationalization in my first project on East German football. So those things came together with Pierre-Yves' support, and kind of came up with this idea of writing one of the quintessential stories, I think, of modern international cultural exchange, and that's football. Because I'm sure it's the same for you, but, you know, the way in which I connect with the world when I'm traveling, you know, if I'm in a taxi or if I'm, you know, in a bar somewhere or if I'm anywhere, it doesn't have to be just in academic conferences, is to talk about sport, and predominantly, I would say, to talk about football. So I guess it was a combination of those kind of personal and professional interests that brought me to think about the international history of sport. And also, I guess just finally on this, I think, and I'm sure obviously you'd be aware of this too, working in the field, that a lot of the ways in which we tell sports history narratives, both kind of popular sports histories, but also I think a lot of academic sports histories, is we tend to do that through the national lens. And mm-hmm. in particular, when, you know, sports history was being built up as a field, you know, in the 70s and 80s in particular, by pioneering figures, you know, it was histories of Italian football, for example, or British football, if I think of someone like Tony Mason and figures like that, all very important contributions to building sport as a serious area of historical study. But what fascinated me, I think, both as an academic and personally, is the way in which sport breaks down those borders, and football in particular breaks down those borders. And so I tried to kind of organize the book in ways in which you could look at the sort of different ways in which these sort of cultural exchanges, political exchanges, economic exchanges through football happened across, you know, 150 years. That, you know, the globalization of football is not a 21st century invention.
No, in fact, one of the things I found the most fascinating about the book was its organization. I mean, so I picked it up and I'm thinking, okay, we have a global history of football, and I was maybe expecting like a more scholarly and punchy, you know, Goldblatt or something, but your organization is completely different and I think really enriching to the discussion instead of this chronological kind of, oh, we start with England and let's move on. Your organization's completely different, so I wonder if you can talk. I don't want to ruin it. I want you to tell us. But
yeah, sure. It's interesting you mentioned David Goldblatt there, who's, you know, I mean, I guess one thing to say is, you know, my book was that I was encouraged, shall we say, to make my book a lot shorter than David Goldblatt's The Ball Is Round. So, you know,
like,
if you're telling the story,
it's impossible to teach because it's too long.
That's right. It's too long, and you know, it's quite heavy to hold up if you've got the paper copy. So yeah, I think about this a lot as a historian, you know, what are the benefits and drawbacks of chronological versus thematic approaches? And in my book, on the previous book I wrote on East German football, which was also a history of the entire period of East German football from sort of 45 to 90. I ended up going with a thematic approach to that book because the story just felt so complex to tell chronologically that you just get kind of bogged down in the narrative details. And I think with a global history of football from whatever, 1863 to 2020, I think I would have probably just gone mad trying to shoehorn that into under 200 pages. So yeah, my approach in the end, and I think there's some risks to it. I think people like narratives in sport. They like things that go in order sometimes. So I guess it could be seen in some ways a little risky, was to think of 9 or 10 themes that really spoke to the globalization of football and football's international story. And within each of those chapters, I guess I broadly tell a story chronologically. But that was the approach I took. So I think I open with a chapter on migrations, which is kind of, you know, the ways in which players have moved around the world from the very early days of football to the kind of upsurge in player transfers from roughly the 90s onwards. Then I talked about, you know, big themes that kind of really speak to us, I think, in sport in 2021 and 2020, like race and gender. Spectators, that was a very complex and big chapter to try and fit into one. So I looked at spectators. Spaces, so looking at stadiums in particular and the ways in which they could be used for political and other purposes. Then the one chapter that had a real difficulty in finding a title for it was ended up with a title of Confrontations. And I'd initially called that chapter Politics, but my series editor, Pierre Eva, pointed out the entire book's about politics.
You know? Yeah.
so Confrontations was meant to be the sort of the ways in which sport can sometimes be the sort of usually the metaphorical site of warring nations, but occasionally the actual site of war between nations. So, yeah, that was the idea, to sort of tell the story in thematic ways that would really show the reader the extent to which football history over this 150 or 160 years has been so globally interconnected in so many different ways for players, coaches, spectators. And I hope readers like it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly liked it. I can see why you would say that that had risks involved as well, too, because I for one, am always constantly telling, you know, encouraging colleagues, encouraging students to write more thematically, but generally worry about straying too far from chronology for the reasons you suggest. Like, people like chronology and storytelling is important too, but for people who are listening and haven't picked up the book, the chapters are migrations, money, competitions, gender, race, spaces, spectators, and confrontations. And before you start the chapters, there is a kind of modern football, a timeline. And in your introduction, you give some of that kind of more historiographic and also chronological discussion. So I thought, like, for my own purposes as a reader, I thought it was really interesting. But also as teacher, I could imagine bringing any one of these chapters into the classroom.
Well, that was another way of thinking about it, because, you know, the book, I mean, I hope the book reaches as wide an audience as possible. But of course, part of the audience that we're looking at here is, you know, there's a global upsurge in sports history courses in universities. I mean, you know that from your own teaching experiences, the same for me, and it's extremely welcome. And it can be difficult to find books that professors can use and that can give students overviews of topics where they could perhaps pull out a chapter. And so I think the thematic approach definitely had that in mind, that students could, you could assign, if you've got a student who's really interested in sports arenas and stadiums, you could assign them that chapter to get a kind of overview of how football spaces have evolved over these 150 years. So yes, I think from the university classroom point of view, there are some benefits to it, I think. And I think also thematic, it helps with analysis, really. I think that's really the benefit of thematic. I think with chronology, it's a safer option, and it does feed into that, you know, maybe that kind of more popular history idea of you tell the story in the order that it happened. But I do think that thematic allows for, yes, a wider analytical framework, maybe, and to bring in different things from different areas. And I think one of the brilliant things that I loved about doing this project was just the research of finding out what colleagues are doing and just just how much stuff there is out there on football and indeed more widely on sports history. Not all of it is absolutely amazing, but there's so much great stuff. And you know, like, so with the thematic approach, you could, you know, you could juxtapose the story in migrations of footballers in various African colonial states, along with, you know, Algeria's relationship with France, Portugal's with Angola and Mozambique. I mean, I think you could just bring the thematic works very well with that global approach. Obviously, I was trying to do in the book.
Yeah, no, I agree. In migration, in reading migrations, I was like, oh, I could see immediately kind of the benefit of this, of the thematic approach, which allowed you to break down some of those national barriers, as you note, but also to look at the issue of migration in a much broader frame too, because you didn't have to have an intervening chapter about World War II or something where you're like, okay, so there's not many people migrating right now and it starts back up again. You could just jump immediately. You could go, oh, I'm in the 1930s and now I'm in the 1960s. And guess what? It's 2000 now. And so,
the interesting thing, actually, when I think about it as we're chatting, is although a lot of the chapters have similar chronological marker points in the sense that the moment when football goes from becoming a mass sport in many parts of Europe and certainly South America is probably in and around and after the First World War, the moment in which you get the kind of sort of first stirrings of sort of post-war celebrity culture, the rise of television and players becoming better paid is probably around the 60s. The real global transformation of football as this giant neoliberal project, if you like, is probably from the 90s onwards. So, you know, you can plug migration or money or even spectators probably into those broad timelines, and they do cohere in different ways. So I think if you're reading the chapters separately, and then they can actually join together in different ways. And, you know, the migration story is interesting because, I mean, you know, one of the tasks I set myself with the book, I think, was to kind of, you know, fill blanks in my own football education, particularly with regards to women's football. And so migration was one in the early chapter. One of the ways in which to do that was to think about some of the ways in which migration of women footballers, as opposed to male footballers, obviously developed at a later point in history, I would say, but developed in some possibly quite interesting in different ways, both in terms of directions and hubs, but also perhaps in terms of motivations. So that was nice to be able to think about, you know, again, almost like I say, to educate myself as much as anything at the beginning, and then hopefully the audience, that all of these stories are not just male-centered stories. And I think, you know, I'm sure all historians, and perhaps particularly white male historians like me, with two kids, two daughters, who I'm trying to persuade to like football as much as me, it felt very important to kind of think about the ways in which we unthinkingly tell the narratives of football or indeed other sports from male perspective. So through migration, you can kind of tell the story from a different perspective and actually have different outcomes, which enrich the story of the migration of male footballers, actually.
Yeah, this raises so many questions for me, actually, and I'm tempted, you know, again, my chronological temptation is to ask you then how the order of the chapters you wrote and things like that, or the decisions you made and why you started with migration. But actually, one of the more interesting, like one thing that when I was reading the book, I literally had to put it down and go, whoa, that's really cool. Is in your chapter called Gender, you start out writing that chapter and you just write about football. You don't write about women's football, but you're writing about women playing football, but you start out by not using the word women. And so contextually, I picked up immediately that you're talking about women playing football, but it was a really interesting choice. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about kind of how you wrote that chapter, why you made that choice at the beginning, and what are you trying to bring out in that chapter?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to give credit to one of my best and oldest friends here, Leon, who planted the seed in my head when we were chatting about ideas for the book and themes, actually. He was the first person, I think, who said to me, you know, you should write the opening of that chapter as if this is the story of football that's handed down to us, you know, the story we're all told by our fathers and grandfathers, or mothers and grandmothers, indeed. And so from that sort of seed of that idea that Leon gave me, I started to think of ways in which you could kind of, well, I suppose slightly wrongfoot the reader in some respects. And I have had a couple of people say to me, oh, okay, I was a bit confused, but then I got it because obviously the context becomes clear. But I think it came back to what I was saying. Almost, I started off in the project thinking about ways in which I had to sort of tell myself to include the story of women footballers in the history of modern football, because, you know, as I was kind of getting across in the introduction to that chapter, the de facto, you know, or the default position rather, is always men's football. We don't need that gender signifier here. So what happens when you take away the gender signifier and just talk about the history of football, meaning women's football rather than men's football? And of course the result is, and as you'll know, if you know the story, if you read the introduction, is you get a very, very different story, a story of grassroots agency, a story of official oppression, or at the very least indifference, and a kind of a global resurgence that happens, you know, probably at a similar time to men's football going viral from the 90s onwards, but in, again, in some very different ways. So yeah, it was a way of making the reader, and also me as an author, think about how we write histories. And in particular, I think histories of sport, because for various reasons, and I'm sure we could unpack some of them if we had time, you know, that it remains in some respects quite a male-centered field, both in terms of subject matter and perhaps even some of the people who participate in it. Now, that is changing, and I see that all the time at conferences. But I think some of those default positions still exist. So by kind of putting women front and center in the story in that chapter, that, you know, kind of re-educates me and hopefully some of the readers there without being too didactic, fingers crossed.
Yeah, no, I mean, conscious of the fact that we're both, you know, acknowledging of the fact that we're both white male historians yes. talking about this, I thought that chapter yeah. was just great, because a lot of times when I've been in the press kind of commenting about the equal pay issue in women's football, and one of the things you always hear when you're in the press or talking about that is, oh, well, it's just the market, you know, mm-hmm. but what your chapter really brings out is that actually, you know, for various reasons, governments and other institutions have supported, subsidized male football for a long time. And, you know, it's only now that once the systems and structures are put in place that people want to talk about the market after 100 years,
you know? Yeah, exactly. And you know, and as I think there's lots of interesting research to show now that, you know, there's always been lots of myths about women and football, about the fact that they didn't play, they weren't interested in the game. And there's actually loads of kind of pretty remarkable research to show the extent to which women were playing football in many different places in the world, not just in England or Scotland, you know, from the late 19th century onwards. And that was consciously, you know, as I mentioned in the chapter, was consciously repressed. You know, in England, famously, the FA outlawed women's football in 1921. Something similar happens in Brazil, in West Germany after World War II. So the stories of kind of, yes, it's not just the market. The market isn't this passive, magical thing which works just by chance to the benefit of men's football clubs and male footballers. That's the product of a series of sort of historical choices by male actors, usually in football associations, I would say, and sometimes in governments, to consciously exclude women from playing football. And the consequences of that, you know, as I say, just thinking about, you know, if I think about growing up, like there was no part of me that really thought about women playing football particularly, because at my, you know, in the schools I was at, you know, generally, this was the 80s, early 90s, generally girls played netball and boys played football, for example, in the UK. But yeah, on the other hand, you know, the biggest football fan I know is my mom. I mean, she's probably the person who taught me. She's probably, you know, she's probably the person who, you know, the most passionate, you know, in good and bad ways, supporter of a team apart from me that I know. So, you know, I'd grown up thinking, you know, I hadn't really thought that my mom was probably the biggest Liverpool fan that I knew. But equally, I grew up in a society where women's football was very much on the margins. That was beginning to change, but not in ways that me as a 14-year-old would have noticed, right? So, yeah, as I say, as much as for the readers, it was the book, writing the book was an education for me in filling in gaps of my ignorance of the history of the sport I love. And so hopefully some of that comes across.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. One of the other chapters when I was perusing it, I thought maybe this was the chapter that I was most distant from, but actually I found it really interesting, was your chapter on money. You write an economic history of football, as you call it. So I wonder if you can talk about how that chapter developed and what are some of the things you're trying to draw out there.
I can talk about that chapter because it's probably the hardest one for me to write, because it's interesting you saying that's the one you're most distant from. And it's kind of true for me as well. I mean, I think I would consider myself more of a kind of a cultural and social historian, I guess. And those are the things that interest me, you know, fan cultures and, you know, resistance through football. I mean, those are themes that were front and center in my book on East German football. So writing about the history of money and football was quite difficult, actually, partly because it was one of the chapters where it felt so overwhelming that it was difficult to kind of get footholds in some ways, and to think about the ways in which money has shaped football. And perhaps also, as I suggest somewhere in the chapter, that football's shaped money. And, you know, I'm not an economic historian. They're not my areas of interest. So I suppose in the chapter on money, I was trying to combine economic history with kind of, if you like, cultural and political history of how football becomes, quote unquote, and it is probably quote unquote, big business, right? How it goes from being, you know, this fairly marginal sport at the start to a global phenomenon played by working class people from many parts of the world, to a sport that becomes, you know, from the 90s onwards, let's say, or perhaps from the 70s onwards, this kind of global behemoth, this financial behemoth, at least in the sporting world. And to be honest with you, I think it's a very difficult chapter to write because the economic history of football is very different if you focus on Western Europe, for example, than it is if you focus on the historical development of football in Africa, for example. So it was quite a difficult chapter to write, but what I tried to do in it was to show the ways in which, firstly, that football was not, and even today, isn't quite the big business. There's a lot of kind of lazy cliches about football, and the idea that it's big business is perhaps one of them. You know, most football clubs even today, you know, operate at losses. Some of the biggest clubs in the world, as you kind of alluded to earlier, get pretty handsome subsidies from local governments or from states for their stadiums and so on in places like Spain and elsewhere. So I guess questioning the idea of football as big business is one aspect of it, but also tracing the ways in which football did become, through its kind of cultural power, really, the ways in which it became this mass sport. It became this money-making business for many people, stakeholders, to use that horrible term, who are involved in football. And so I looked a bit at the debates about between amateurism and professionalism in the early days of football's development, the professionalization of leagues, and trying to pinpoint the moments at which football perhaps begins to move away from its working-class roots, while always being wary as a kind of now middle-aged man that I can kind of sound a bit nostalgic there, you know, as if the old days of football were all great. But so trying to pick the moments at which football really takes off into the stratosphere in which it now finds itself, you know, as something, because I think a lot of perhaps younger readers maybe might not always know this, but, you know, football, when I was growing up in the 80s in England, and I have distinct memories as a 9 or 10 year old of sitting down to watch the 1985 European Cup final in my full Liverpool kit, and then the game being delayed because of the crowd trouble and the Liverpool fans charging the Juventus fans and 39 people dying. And football at that moment, certainly in Britain, but I think also in other parts of the world, was not the kind of culturally fashionable thing it is now. It wasn't the thing that had all the lucrative contracts around it that it does now. So the kind of resurrection of football, if you like, the economic resurrection of football, is an interesting theme, I think, from the sort of 90s onwards. How does football resurrect itself? And I think, with a rather bitter irony, it's in many ways in response to some of those stadium disasters and football hooliganism in the 80s that football kind of gets its house in order in the 90s, but in ways that perhaps price out ordinary supporters, if you like. So it's a complex story, the money one. And I'm glad, even though the chapter's distant to you, that you got something out of it. Because I did find that quite a challenge to kind of figure the way through that one. Yeah.
One of the things I like most about that chapter is, in addition to the things that you've mentioned, is I found in my teaching that students tend to assume a kind of they assume that the football world that exists today, in terms of rich clubs and poor clubs and money and the movement of players, has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't understand that, you know, in the 50s, why maybe Brazilians would have stayed playing at Santos mm-hmm. instead of, you know, why not come to Europe? And didn't everyone always want to play for Real Madrid? And, mm-hmm. you know, and this chapter really traces out that the production of these vast inequalities that actually don't, they're obviously not normal, or just to say not natural artifacts. They're produced historically, but also they're not forever. they are produced in particular moments. And so that was really useful for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a couple of things there that are interesting. One is that and this kind of ties into the previous chapter on migration, because migration and money, you know, go quite well together. You know, the migratory roots of football have not always been the roots you'd expect. You know, there's been periods like in the 1920s, for example, when the US was making some of its first attempts to establish a soccer league where players made journeys the other way, for example. There was the brief period after World War II when the Colombian League was flush with money and was kind of kicked out of FIFA, and players from Britain and elsewhere went to get paid well and play in Colombia. So I think both in terms of patterns of the transnational flow of players and money, has not always been in the directions we think. And they're not, as you're absolutely right in saying, they're not fixed entities. You know, the big clubs of today have not always been the big clubs. They've not always been the clubs that have drawn players from around the world. And so I think, yeah, this kind of ties into what I was saying about the kind of my memories of football growing up was, you know, and if you read something like Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch, right, which was published in, I think, 92, you know, I mean, that was published at a time when there wasn't really a fan culture literature, right? He was kind of writing from the perspective of what were then pariahs, people who really loved football. And so there's a lot of changes that have happened since then, and they seem normalized now because we've had 30 years of the game becoming bigger and bigger and more advertised and more televised. But that story has not always been one way, you're right to say. And the directional travel of players and money hasn't always been in one direction either.
Yeah, for me, that was one of the big takeaways of that chapter, that just showed mm-hmm. so clearly the in some ways newness and possibly temporariness of some of these financial arrangements that
the interesting thing thinking about this, like the you know, timing's everything, right? Of course, this book, Contested Fields, was published, I think, about maybe a week or 2 weeks before the entire world shut down with the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, you know, that would have made a perfect extra chapter. I don't know if you're doing the same, but I'm already teaching in my sports history class. We have a unit on, you know, global sport and COVID-19, you know. So, but to your point, the arrangements in sport can be temporary. I mean, I think one of the things COVID-19 showed, and is probably still showing, is the ways in which football and other sports have been financially impacted by COVID-19. Now, of course, you know, we haven't seen any high-profile clubs around the world yet declare themselves bankrupt, and they're probably going to survive.
That's a very big yet.
yeah, that is a big yet. Exactly. We're still pretty early in the game. And, you know, I think there's an argument you could say, you know, that they're quote-unquote too big to fail, to use that term from the banking crisis of 2009. But I think COVID-19 and its kind of impact on sport, which happened literally just after the book was published, sadly. But, you know, that shows the fragility of some of these arrangements, right? That things can change quite quickly. And things that we just assume, whether it's about spectating or playing or television and sport, can suddenly be swept away from us. So, yeah, I think it's good to remind people that the story of football, this success story that FIFA, UEFA, the English Premier League and others have kind of marketed since the 90s, which has a lot of validity to it. But A, there are darker sides to that, obviously, and B, it wasn't always thus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm always about contesting FIFA's particular narrative.
Yes, I think that's probably, I think actually that was one of the other things that was just thinking finally on the money chapter. One of the other difficult things is like, well, how do you write this chapter with any sort of semblance of academic temperance and balanced objective nature when you're writing about something as venal and corrupt as Fifi? You know, it's a little bit hard to do, isn't it? You know, luckily many people, investigative journalists and historians, have done the work for me. So, you know, I was indebted to them for wading through all the muck and filth of FIFA's dealings so I could synthesize it in a few pages.
It's funny. Yeah, they're interesting. They're interesting, difficult to work with group sometimes from a historian's perspective. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. The chapter I wrote on competitions, which obviously talks about kind of to some degree about international governance of sport and the evolution of kind of international competition, which of course in shape of the World Cup and other big events becomes huge money-making enterprises. I mean, one of the fascinating elements of the global history of modern football, I think, is international governance, right? The ways in which FIFA emerges from the shadows of the International Olympic Committee to become certainly its equal. And some might argue today, you know, it's kind of the greater power of the two major supranational sports organizations. So, I mean, FIFA's, you know, pops up in the narrative in many different ways and places, not always very favorably. But I think, I suppose, if we were crediting, you have to give some credit to the organizations, whatever their motives for spreading the game. Even a figure as reviled now as João Havelange, who becomes FIFA president in 1974, you know, whatever the many faults and corruptions around the Havelange presidency of FIFA, you know, the game, he kept to his promises of globalizing the game and making it less Eurocentric and frankly racist, which, you know, it had been for much of the first 60 or 70 years of its existence.
I mean, absolutely. You know, the importance of FIFA and to a lesser extent the IOC in democratizing the game. Your chapter on competitions bring some of that out, but you're also, I mean, you do temper that with discussions of, you know, mega events. And I don't think it's far from mind that, you know, FIFA's a rights holder and not a magician of, you know, football.
And not just
they
this,
own
not
the just game. They own the World Cup, quote unquote, TM, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I remember going to the 2006 World Cup in Germany and, you know, there were the whole thing, and you know, there was lots of talk about, you know, what beers you could have in and around the stadium. Because, of course, I think Budweiser had the contract for the stadium.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, even some clothing I was wearing had the FIFA kind of, the people checking the bags and so on were kind of worried about kind of the wrong branding being on the hat I was wearing or something. And you think, oh, this is where we've got to really, you know. So it's, yeah, there's lots of elements of the story that are quite unsavory and pretty depressing, of course. And that's, I think, the fascinating element of the globalization of football story is that there's the kind of marketing spiel of FIFA and all its trademarks, which is one element of the story. But there's also the other element of the story, and I, you know, try and get to that bit through things like spectator cultures and the kind of the more grassroots connections between fans and players and so on and so forth, the ways in which, as you suggest, not, you know, a lot of the global history of football is not run because of the munificence of FIFA, and it's not run through FIFA. FIFA is an important part of the story, but there's, I mean, what's always interested me is the ways in which international connections can occur through sport, not just through the official and diplomatic channels of governance, but at all different levels. And I think that's always, you know, as a sort of more of a cultural and a social history, and that's always what's really fascinated me about sport as an international practice.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I guess I'd love to take some time, you've mentioned it a few times, but to turn specifically to that chapter on spectators and maybe also kind of confrontations at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of it is kind of read through the lens of resistance. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you were trying to do in talking about spectators and confrontations.
Yeah, I mean, I've been subtly hinting we should move on to talk about spectators. So there we go. We finally made it to do that. So that's good.
You really have to hit me over the head with it.
So we have to talk about money. Let's get on to fans. But it's all very interesting. I think this, I mean, I've grappled with this issue of sport as a site of you know, resistance or opposition a lot in classes I've taught, also in my work on East German football, where, you know, I, kind of one of the central arguments of the people's game is that football, you know, becomes a really important site of cultural and in some ways political autonomy for East Germans, which is not to say that football led to the fall of the Berlin Wall or anything like that. But if you look in the 1980s, you know, we know a lot in East Germany about the peace and the environmental movements and the beginnings of kind of dissident movements in East Germany. But really the thing that most East Germans were pissed off about in the 1980s was the dominance of the Stasi team, the secret police team, Dynamo Berlin, who won the league every year by allegedly having referees in their pocket. And that was exciting public anger like nothing else. You know, in stadiums, you get cries of Stasi out or the wall must go, which, of course, could be a reference to a free kick or something much more political. So I was always interested, even before coming to contested fields, in the ways in which football and sport more generally can work as sites of protest. And of course, that topic's only become more current in the past year with the sort of rise of athlete activism through Black Lives Matter and various other sort of, you know, the increased political engagement of athletes is a really interesting element of the story. But yes, here I was focusing more on spectators and kind of some of the ways in which, I mean, I was really interested in the spectator chapter and thinking about and unpicking the ways in which spectator cultures, which are often nationalized, I think, you know, like the English hooligan, you know, the Italian ultra and so on and so forth, the ways in which spectator cultures kind of rubbed against each other and influenced each other, and found some fascinating examples of that, you know, like Yugoslav fans in the 1950s who took inspiration from kind of fan culture that they saw from Brazilian fans that they'd encountered through the 1950 World Cup, as one example. Just this brilliant levels of sort of informal cultural exchange that happened through spectatorship. That was a really fascinating element of the story here.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if we've said enough just how transnational the work is. We focused a little bit in our discussion on kind of Europe, but it's not just a story about Europe and its and European teams. And it I will kind of for listeners, I want to really emphasize like that we're both European historians in some ways, so I think we're more comfortable talking in those spaces, but. You, through a really broad reading, really bring in soccer from almost everywhere in the globe and spectator experiences from a really wide range of places.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because, I do tend to defer, I suppose, to a Eurocentricity in what I'm thinking about because that's what I've done most of my own research. But yes, I was very conscious in the book of trying to get beyond the kind of Western European and South American, big three South American centers of world football, I suppose, and to think about what was happening in other parts of the football world, and including in parts of the world that are not often seen as being as quote-unquote football friendly. So I was particularly interested in, you know, in, especially in these chapters on spectator culture and then on confrontation and resistance, in the ways in which football was used as a kind of agent of colonial, anti-colonial resistance. I mean, that's fascinated me in courses I've taught, you know, the experience of the Algerian footballers who essentially walk out on the French national team in the late 50s to join the team of the revolutionary movement of the National Liberation Front, the FLN, during the Algerian War, as just one example of the ways in which football was tied into to wider issues in the transnational world, and decolonization was one of these, I think. So yes, there's so many great stories, particularly from colonial and post-colonial Africa, of football's central importance in kind of inventing the nation. You know, I think about a country like Ghana, for example, maybe also Tanzania. They're places where football was very important to the political elites that took power at independence, and become central to their efforts to kind of create both national and pan-African identities. I think of the case of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana here. You know, football and the creation of the AFCON and hosting the AFCON, the African Cup of Nations, is a huge part of Ghana's sort of entry onto the international, certainly the continental political stage in the 1960s. So yeah, tried to go as much as possible beyond the tried and tested fields that I know the best, Britain and Germany and other places, and get out in the world. And that was the brilliant thing was I found football stories everywhere. You know, just people have done some amazing research, like anthropological field research from, you know, indigenous groups, you know, in the jungles of Peru, where as one reading I found, that the center of the village was the football pitch. Like, it's not like, I don't know, the town hall or even the equivalent of a bar or a pub. It's the football pitch is the geographical center of the village. So all of that stuff is just fascinating because you see the ways in which football has so many other levels of story that we can tell. And, you know, I really was, there wasn't enough of it in the book, but I was, you know, just trying to tell some of the grassroots stories of football, whether it's from fan culture or migratory players, you know, because some people who migrate are amateur footballers. Trying to get some of that into the story was also fun as well.
Talking with you and thinking back to reading of it, it just strikes me again how difficult it must have been to actually decide on these categories, because you could have equally had a chapter called grassroots in your chapter.
Yeah, that was,
on
I think
race.
That was on my initial list, actually. Yeah.
You know, your chapter on race and migration both speak to the kind of importance of football in shaping identity, whether they're hybridized or non-hybridized mm-hmm. identities. But then all of this comes back to confrontations and state-making programs. So it's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that sense, you know, to go back to something I was mentioning earlier, although the thematic approach in some ways, as we were saying, is possibly a little riskier and a bit harder to follow in some respects, I think a lot of these stories do coalesce. Race and migration, you know, the interconnectedness of those two stories is huge, obviously. Confrontations, political confrontations through football, we see in many of the different chapters. They just kind of reach a peak, I suppose, in that final chapter where I look at, you know, some of the most famous examples of football confrontation. Grassroots was one of my chapters.
Gender
and spectators. Yeah. Gender and migration too, as we talked about earlier. But yes, I mean, it's something I've been thinking about actually for something else I've been writing recently is about Liverpool. Actually, is kind of the, and you know, again, it's kind of starts from my mum really. But you know, like the you know, the this default idea that's very widespread, I think, in, if we can call it, fan literature that's emerged around football in the past 30 years. You know, some of it's the hooligan literature, some of it's kind of sort of post-Nick Hornby literature. The default position, again, is almost always male. And so, again, trying to kind of get past that and think about the ways in which spectatorship was never exclusively a male domain, even in periods when we associate it exclusively with men. And so I think that was... Yeah, I mean, so gender comes into a number of the different chapters and kind of reinforces what I wrote in the specific gender chapter, hopefully.
So I write out like a list of questions, and we've touched on many of them, but there's so many more particular ones. I don't necessarily, you know, I could jump around, but I wonder if you want to talk to us a little bit about, because in your conclusion, you raise some, I think, interesting questions about kind of the future of football studies, the difficulties of, you know, studying football. And again, you published this book before COVID, so there's probably things to add. So I guess, you know, what is kind of the future of football studies for you? I'll give you some space to talk about your next project too, but where do you think the field is going? You know, where should we be going?
Well, I mean, I think... In terms of kind of, I think the redressing of the balance in terms of kind of the male-centeredness of football history is something I think, and of course, football and sports history is not the only fields in our profession that are currently grappling with that. That's, you know, a pretty widespread debate. So I think that's one thing that is beginning to happen. So that we don't have a history of football that is just male-dominated. And of course, even, you know, my history of football, you know, tries to include as much of women's football history as possible, but it's still overwhelmingly, like if I think of the chapter on competitions, I do mention the emergence of the Women's World Cup, but it's mostly men's competition. So I think, you know, work that moves us to kind of correct those gender imbalances is important. Personally, as someone who likes cultural and social history, I mean, I'm really interested in sporting histories that kind of get to the basis of, for example, a big bugbear of mine is, and as this comes across in the book, I'm sure, although I have to write about it, is the obsessive focus in football spectator literature, both academic and non-academic, on hooliganism. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in kind of thinking about how football and other sports are consumed more widely away from that. And I think trying to get at that is an important element of the story. I mean, I think one of the difficulties of football and sports history, generally speaking, and I think, you know, I think of this from my various encounters with football clubs I've tried to talk to, both in Germany and Britain, and also you mentioned trying to get hold of them or trying to get contacts with them, international organizations too. I think, you know, that it's difficult to sometimes find a corpus or a source base for football history. It can be quite all over the place. Mm-hmm. We're quite isolated figures as sports historians. You know, there are one or two honorable exceptions. There aren't too many places where there's a great gathering of sports historians in one institution. So often it feels like, I mean, one of the great things about this project was just uncovering new work by people I knew by name or had met once at a conference and kind of really getting into the work and seeing how much there is out there that's really starting to push football and sports history in some of these directions. And to me, those directions should be transnational. They should be inclusive on issues of gender and race. And they should, I think, be more interested. And this is something I'm always conscious of trying to tell a story. And this book is not really the right book for that entirely, but trying to tell a story of sport from the bottom up as much as possible, from a grassroots perspective. I mean, I had a section in my book on East German football where I tried to move beyond the sort of the elite game in East Germany and look at how people played the game, how it was part of their everyday life. And I think that to me is a really fascinating element of the sports history and football history story that remains to be told. And the grassroots combined with a kind of women's history of football is a really, that's really productive, I think, because a lot of women's football history, as I mentioned in the book, you know, had to be kind of driven from below because it was being ostracized at the top and being kind of isolated and starved of funding. So I think, you know, historians and others, sociologists and others, are beginning to do that. So I think those are some of the main directions. But honestly, there's so many different ways in which you can go that it's pretty hard to pick it down, even before COVID hit. And I thought, oh man, there was my extra chapter that I needed to write. My book is already obsolete. So, you know, that's the perils of publishing at any time, I suppose. No,
definitely not obsolete. No. I actually, as a scholar in the field, I love the book for those reasons. And it made me think a little bit differently about migration and about money. And, in terms of somebody who teaches a unit on sports history, I was like, oh, well, these chapters are immediately extremely useful. And I can totally see myself assigning these chapters. And they would be great for students, not only because they're great in terms of their kind of analytical precision, but also because in your wide-ranging approach, because you look at spectatorship, for example, in so many different places, it really helps solve for me the problem that I always have, which is when students go, I'm interested in X theme, I just don't know where to or what to work on. And you can go, oh, you're interested in spectatorship. Great. Read this chapter.
Yeah, that's right. You just point them in the direction of it. And I think, and it's interesting, I think, to go back to a point I was mentioning earlier, that I think when people say to me, you know, I'm interested in this topic, it does tend to be, I think we nationalize a lot of sports history. And so I think one of the things I really enjoyed about the project and hopefully came across and I'm glad it did to you was the way I loved all the different connections between spectator cultures. And they might not be direct connections, but the ways in which fans behave in similar ways or the ways in which they take influence from each other, for example. That's just to me fascinating and speaks to the ways in which football is the quintessential international story of a kind of modern cultural, political, economic history. I mean, it is a global story. And I think it's the most productive and I think the most interesting way to tell the story of football. And I guess that was imbued in me when I was a little kid and I, without even thinking about it, you know, I was more interested in Scotland and West Germany and then later East Germany than I was in the country that I grew up playing and watching football, England. And so I think that's the beautiful thing about sport, right? That we, you know, we can root for teams and players that have nothing to do with us. And I think to get across a sense of that, the positive elements of that international story in the spectators chapter in particular, not just the hooligan story, was important to me, you know.
Well, I'm very keen, and I do want to ask you in a second, and maybe given what you're saying, that maybe you're working on something like this, but I want to see, one of the directions I see maybe football studies going is in a history of post-fandom, mm-hmm. which I think would be really interesting, plays right into those ideas you're talking about. Although I guess, since you mentioned being an Englishman who's interested in German football, I do wonder if you're going to be conflicted in a week or so.
That's right. I'm good. I'm going to be. I'll have two different hats on when the two teams play. But yeah, it's funny. I'm a Liverpool supporter, and of course Liverpool, and this will bring me on to some of the stuff I'm working on, but Liverpool has always been prided itself in its kind of Scouse, not English approach. And I mean, that's one of the other interesting elements of football history, is that there's lots of local and regional identities. And I always thought football was interesting from that point of view, because yes, there's the national history of national teams, but there's also extremely intense local identity in football and sport, particularly football. But that local identity can then be transplanted to other parts of the world, right? You know, that you can get, you know, there's this huge Liverpool following in Australia and many other places,
giant,
right? You know,
giant, yeah.
So, huge. I mean, and it's a lot of people who've never set foot, some people anyway, who've never had the fortune to set foot in Liverpool Stadium, Anfield. So, I mean, yeah, anyway, yes. No, but I mean, the post-fan would be an interesting thing to talk about. Absolutely. And you know, I think, maybe there's a younger generation of historians who can do that better than me, because I feel I'm getting too old and crusty to, you know, waxing nostalgic about the old days of fandom. So maybe there's a younger generation of scholars who can do that for me.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're not old and crusty entirely. It sounds like you have a new project on some kind of Scouse football.
The ultimate vanity project, right? Like, you know, you kind of you know, we began our discussion by talking about, well, how did you end up becoming a football historian? And now I'm taking it to the nth degree by trying to tackle writing about the club that I've grown up supporting, and my, you know, my family's, some of my dad's side of the family is from Liverpool. And so I'm writing a sort of a cultural and social history of, and an international history, I should say, really, of Liverpool Football Club, focusing on the off the field stuff, you know, the fan culture in particular, and the international element of that story. So actually the project builds on what I've been doing in contested fields in terms of thinking about the international connections that come through one football club. So yeah, research has been a bit stymied, obviously, by COVID, as I'm sure is the case for all of us.
Yeah.
But just had a couple of pieces published that are kind of working towards that. And I'm also working, just to go back to your point about wearing two hats. So that's my English football hat. I also have a German football hat, and I'm just finishing up working as an editor on a collection on Football Nation, which is going to be out with Burkhan probably in about a year or so, which is a collection of essays on German football culture, history, and society. So I have definitely got one foot in each of those rival camps.
I'm looking forward to both of those projects, and I'm hopeful to see them both out soon.
I'll do my best, Keith. It's been great talking to you.
Great. So thank you all for listening. My name's Keith Rathbone. This is the New Books in Sports podcast, the channel on the New Books Network. I've been speaking with Alan McDougall. He's a professor of history at the University of Guelph, and he is the author of the much recommended Contested Fields, A Global History of Modern Football, out with University of Toronto Press in 2020. Thank you very much for joining me, Alan.
Thank you very much, Keith.